I'm going to be out of town on Election Day. I have an annual minister's study group in Southern Illinois that I go to every year. We move it in presidential years, but in the other years, you got to vote absentee. So I went Thursday morning to vote. Filled out my ballot, page one, turned the page, filled it out, page two, looked at it and thought, wait a minute. Something's not right here. I went up to the counter and I said, there's a problem. You're missing an election. Maybe you saw in the paper on Friday how this election error, the missing Forest Preserve commissioner race, was caught by a voter who asked about it. That was me. I have a friend who's running for the office, and I was excited to vote for her, but she wasn't on my ballot. Now this problem's going to get solved. It's going to cost a little bit of money. If you voted absentee, you're going to get a new ballot. I'm going to have to go back next week in person and try to vote again. But you know, it wasn't the only problem with the ballot. It was the only one I could complain about in the office and have them fix, but it's not the only problem with the ballot. Some races, only one person is running. The district's so gerrymandered that there's no point of a challenge. Even when there were three candidates, we all know that other folks, where are you, Dave? There he is. Try to get on the ballot, but it's a little hard to do in Illinois sometimes. I was looking forward to voting for you again. There's a measure to increase the minimum wage, but it won't actually do anything. It's just advisory. But the biggest problem with the ballot isn't on it. It's not the missing election or a missing name. It's that it all feels so futile. Like we're limiting the damage at best, but we're not making any progress. That the game is rigged, that the players are bought and sold, that even when good people take office, there's not much they seem to be able to do. We get distracted by this or that, and we yell at each other, but I want to know, where is it on the ballot that we mourn the death of Michael Brown, killed in Ferguson, Missouri, or John Crawford, killed in the aisles of a Walmart in suburban Ohio, or the hundreds of other young men and women shot dead unarmed by police? Where on the ballot do I honor, as Effa Michael Weaver put it, these feet that marched and ran and got cut off, these hearts torn out by nameless thieves? Where do I do that? Where do we as a nation confess and make amends for hundreds of years of genocide, theft, and violence towards people of color in our own lands and in others? For that matter, where on the ballot do the people of Bangladesh or the South Pacific get to vote, since our refusal to be serious about climate change will put their country underwater? Shouldn't they get a say about that? Where on the ballot do we get to say this economic system isn't working for us? Where do we say a higher minimum wage might be fine, but that won't address the worldwide plutocracy that seems to have taken over? Where on the ballot do we get to say, look at this chart? Tom, can we look at the next chart? This chart. This one shows the change in net worth in the Great Recession. And you can see the drop and the difference. It even more shows the effects of slavery and Jim Crow and housing and employment discrimination. Where on the ballot do we get to say this is unconscionable? Where on the ballot do we get to say that every politician, every American should read this essay? This essay, Tom, by Ta-Nehisi Coates. Can we do the next one? This one, The Case for Reparations. How many of you have already read it? Any of you? Okay, the rest of you should read it too. Just Google The Case for Reparations, you'll find it. It explains why that chart is the way that it is, that it isn't an accident. Where on the ballot do we get to vote that something needs to be done about this? Because our conscience will not rest until it is. Where on the ballot do we get to talk about dramatic income inequality, about how this so-called recovery isn't for most folks, about this chart, this one? This shows that how for 90% of Americans, that's the blue line, actual income growth in this recovery, that's the one on the end, is down. It's less. Rising tide sinks most boats. It's only up for the top 10%, though some might be having a recovery most of us sure the hell ain't. Where do we get to vote about that? And do we get to vote about this one, this next one? This is giving. And you can see it's down for those making more than $100,000 a year, while everybody else is up. So even the wealthy who are making more and more money are giving less to charity, while everybody else is giving more, even though they're making less. Do we get to vote about that? Because I know a lot of nonprofit leaders and church leaders and folks in need of social services, the folks that we talked about, who'd like to talk about this, who'd like to have a vote about this. I could go on. We'll go back to the flower. There we go. I could go on. I'm really just getting warmed up, actually. But suffice it to say, the missing forest preserve race wasn't the only thing missing from the ballot. Suffice it to say that our politics, our economic system, our civic life stands in desperate need of renewal. We need to renew our common life together, to recenter our conversations on what is most essential, to stand up for human dignity for everyone, for opportunity for everyone, for justice and fairness and what's right. We need to renew our common life together. And it isn't going to happen by filling out a ballot. Although you should still go and do that, because if you don't do at least that, it's just going to get worse. But a ballot by itself isn't going to cut it. Not for the work of renewal that is before us. For that, we need something more, something powerful. We need faith. We need a commitment to higher values, a hope that things can get better, and a determination to be part of the solution. Knowledge that the struggle takes time, but that the arc of history does bend when we help it towards justice. We need hope, and we need courage. And we should know that our hope and our courage is justified. It's been a long time coming, but a change is going to come. This hope, this aspiration, this belief, a change is going to come, even if it's been a long time coming. This hope is at the core of American progressive religious thinking. It's our most essential attitude. Our hope and courage is justified. Yes, we can. Si se puede. We can make the world better. We can improve things and change things with hard work and struggle and persistence and honesty and most of all, love. With love, we can change things for the better. This is the story we tell ourselves about who we are and what we have already done. We lift up those spiritual ancestors of ours who did that. Who did change things, the abolitionists and the suffragists, the civil rights leaders and the environmentalists, the gay rights pioneers and the advocates for the poor. They joined with others. They made a difference. It wasn't easy. It's been a long time coming, but a change will come. We stand on the shoulders of giants. And this is our source of hope. In the midst of struggle, we believe in change, in the power of good people to make things better, in the inexorable force of justice to overcome oppression. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom. In the power of life to break through concrete sidewalks and bloom. This is our source of hope, and there are times, we should note, there are times that our hope feels justified. We've won some of these fights. There are times we win. There are times we win. And sometimes we forget that we did. We get so wrapped up in the next fight, we're ready to do what needs to be done next, that we don't pause to celebrate, to remember what it took to win. So before you get too overwhelmed by the struggle and jump into the next fight, remember and celebrate, we just won a big one. I'm talking about marriage equality. 25 years, Unitarian Universalists have been working on it. And now, this week, couples are getting married after decades together, in many cases in Arizona and West Virginia and Wyoming and Wisconsin and Indiana. The writing's been on the wall on this for at least a decade. Once Massachusetts did it, it felt possible. When Iowa made it real, you knew it was just a matter of time. But that was quick, wasn't it? We forget how quick this change happened in the scheme of things. Andrew Sullivan reminds us how it happened. People came out. They told their stories. Real life, real stories. That's how it happened. The moral majority for the dignity of every person's capacity to love and be loved. I love the way that Andrew Sullivan calls this the moral majority. Did you catch that? The new moral majority. We won. Pat Robertson lost. And we're not going to gloat, at least not too much, just a little bit. Because the fight's not over and there's more work to do. Parenting rights aren't equal yet, and trans folks are still very vulnerable to discrimination and violence. There's a lot more work. But let's remember, this was a big win. We worked for it for a long time. Sometimes our hope is justified. Sometimes love wins. The civic covenant is expanded. Unfortunately, it seems sometimes that racism and greed is a lot harder to defeat than heterosexism. Racism is ingrained into American life in a way that heterosexism just isn't. Racism remains persistent and creative and insidious and interwoven into American civic life. We think we win, we get abolition, and then it's Reconstruction. And it's the end of that. And then it's Jim Crow. And we think we defeated in civil rights, and then it's mass incarceration. It's like whack-a-mole, except people's lives are at stake. Because gay and lesbian folks turn out to be, well, everywhere. In every family, eventually people had to say, well, I guess they're just like us. But for a lot of white folks, people of color will forever be not like us. Always something other. Here's the kicker. Here's the essential piece of understanding why it's so hard to defeat. Racism is a tool of power and greed, the power of economic elites and political control. The very idea of race was created to justify and solidify economic power. This is the history, to divide working classes from each other. And racism was and is carefully taught to maintain the social order, the social system. Fear, in particular, fear of the young black man, this fear is cultivated on purpose to distract working class white folks from the injustice of the social order, to maintain support for systems of social control, as a way to say to poor whites, don't complain, don't organize, it could be worse, you could be black. Fear is the powerful tool of oppression. You can draw a straight line from plantation owners who said, fear the slave rebellion, let us do whatever it takes, to Jim Crow and mass incarceration, Willie Horton, to Michael Brown and John Crawford. Big protests about that last week in Ferguson, about Michael Brown. But what dominates the news this week? Ebola. 38,000 people die of the flu every year, but let's all panic about Ebola, why don't we? That's something to be scared of. That's all right. That's from Africa. Seems very clear to me as I look out over this country where we are right now that this unfinished work of ending racism, of fighting it tooth and nail, whether we find it in our own hearts or in others down the block or across the country, this work must be, is at the core of what we mean when we say we are called to renew our common life. That our task is this, to steal the sun back from the greedy Wendigo and share it with everyone. Even if that act of transgression turns those of us who look like white ravens black. That's what solidarity looks like. We must connect the dots between racism and classism and misogyny, for they are connected, a three-headed Medusa of disenfranchisement. And this is our work. To renew our common life, to sing and pray and step until peace and justice and democracy is for everyone. Until democracy means what we say it means, until everyone gets to participate in the civic life, that civic authorities, especially the police, treat everyone equally with dignity, even, yes, even unarmed black teenagers. Until the ballot really matters, isn't a sham. Until elections are won by the best ideas and not the highest bidder. Until we deal with the horrific legacy of the past and the present with respect to wealth and power. Until that day, our work for renewal must continue. We are singing, we are angry, but we will be gentle. And we are singing for our lives, no matter what we might look like, not theirs, for it is our most fundamental universalist conviction that we are all kin to each other, each and every one of us. Our lives, ours, are bound together. The ancient Hebrew prophets spoke of the responsibility of people of faith to renew the civic life and to do justice. They said, God cares for the poor, the immigrant, the orphan, the widow, the one left out. That's the one that God cares for. And they said, that's our work, to care for the ones left out, to ensure that the kingdom, the nation, the city, the neighborhood, the world is a world that includes each one, for each one is a child of the Holy. Each one has dignity. And those ancient Hebrew prophets said, it will come, a change, a long time coming, but it comes. And we help bend the arc. We do the work of the world to renew our lives together, to raise up devastations of old, to heal the sick and release the prisoner, to make justice roll down like waters, to make love the spirit of the world, to have hope and courage. This is our work. This is our calling. This is what we need to vote for, not just on paper, but in life, in our hands and hearts. This is our work. So I tell you, have hope, have courage, see clearly, don't give up. Engage the world, renew the world, be the change you wish to see, sing for our lives, all of them. Take another step. Have hope, have courage, and let us renew this world, this place, and let us begin together. I invite you to sing 121.